Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
There are two metal stools in my kitchen that I'm weirdly fond of. I picked them out strictly because I was drawn to them. They were functional and, best of all, truly unique. Or maybe not so unique. Within weeks of bringing them home, I started noticing similar chairs everywhere in a rainbow of colors at restaurants and bars and in friends' homes. I just hadn't noticed before. Could it be that what I thought was an independent choice was actually the result of some subtle peer pressure I wasn't aware of? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. After reading Jonah Berger's new book, I'm pretty sure the answer is yes. But I don't feel too bad about it. We are all affected by the tastes, habits, and beliefs of the people around us. And that influence can be a good thing if we know how to recognize and harness it. Jonah Berger is professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Invisible Influence: The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. Jonah, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So what's up with my chairs? Did I not realize that everything in the world was telling me to buy these things?
That's such a great example. And, you know, from the simple stuff like what chairs to buy or what breakfast cereal to pick up at the store to the more complicated things like should we switch jobs or which house we should buy, we think those decisions lie within us, our preferences, our likes, our dislikes. But unfortunately, or fortunately in some cases, we're actually wrong. Other people end up making those decisions for us. And it's not just the folks we might think. It's not just our friends or our family members. Sometimes even strangers or people that don't know us very well and we don't know very well can have a surprising impact on how we behave. And so the book is all about how we can understand that and how we can harness its power.
What are the pros and cons of the way that evolution has wired humans to be susceptible to social influence?
You know, we tend to think of influence as a bad thing. It's almost a four-letter word, sort of a dirty word. No one, at least in the United States, wants to see themselves as influenced. And yet, without influence, life would be a lot more difficult. Imagine, for example, you had to find a new babysitter or pick where to get your car repaired without asking anybody else. You just had to go out there and figure it out by yourself. Life would be a lot harder and a lot more complicated. And so following others, using influence, is often a way to help us make faster and better decisions. But you're certainly right that sometimes it can lead us astray. We've all been in those meetings where, you know, we think one thing is the right answer, but the first person says something and then everybody goes along and we end up going a completely different direction. And so influence can both be good and bad, depending on the context.
You have this remarkable, it's a visual example in the book, but I think you can describe it pretty easily for people. There are two graphics and one of them has one line and the other has three lines. And people in this study were simply asked to say which of the three lines in box two match the length of the line in box one.
This is a famous study in psychology, and it's a particularly interesting one because it really shows the power of influence. So imagine you're brought into a room with five or six people that look pretty much like you, and there's a table. They're sitting around the table. You pick the last seat left, which is the one on the end, and someone tells you your job today is to do some task on visual perception. Just as you nicely noted, you're going to look at a line. Imagine a line on a sheet of paper, and guess which of three other lines it matches. And those three other lines have a small line, a medium line, and a longer line. And so you're going to see a target line and say, well, is it the same as the small, the medium, or the large? It should be really easy. And indeed, when people do this by themselves, they pretty much get it right 100% of the time. So you look at this particular one, and it looks like the answer is A, but they don't ask you first. They ask someone else at the table. And your colleague says, I guess it's B. And you look at them like they're a little bit weird. Okay, maybe one person got it wrong, but then the next person goes and they go B. And then the next person goes and they say, well, it's probably B. And eventually gets to you and everybody said B and you're sitting there going, God, my eyes say it's A, but if everyone else said B, what should I do? And notice we're in this situation a lot, right? Imagine you're out to dinner with a group of friends and you're planning on getting dessert. You've looked at the menu. You already know what you want. You're really excited about it. But when the waiter comes around and asks who wants dessert, everybody else sort of begs off and says, I'm not really into it. And then it gets around to you. Are you still going to order dessert when everyone else didn't? And so what's neat about these situations is even when the right answer is clear, like the length of lines, or when we're not a right answer, when we're out to dinner, we tend to follow others in those situations. We don't want to be the only one doing something. So we go along with the crowd, even though our eyes tell us it's wrong.
Is it particularly American to resist acknowledging this kind of influence? We just revere rugged individualism in this society.
We do, and it's amazing if you look at the way people raise their kid. That's a perfect microcosm of this. You know, everyone thinks their kids are special, unique snowflakes, different from everyone else. They only need to figure out, you know, their way, how they're going to grow up as that flower that's different from all the rest of the flowers, and you're special, and you're different, and my kids should play more and have it our way. And we're used to this notion that every one of us is really different. What's really interesting, though, is if you look at some other cultures, take Japan, for example, or China or much of Asia, there people look pretty much the same as they do in the U.S. There are some similarities, there are some differences, but there fitting in is much more valued. There it's about being a good member of the group and honoring your parents and honoring your family. But in the United States, you know, one reason we don't see influence is because we think it's bad. We think it's bad to be influenced by others. Why would I want others to affect my decisions? I want to be independent and unique. Notice, by the way, that sometimes when we're being independent, though, we're really just doing the opposite of everybody else. You know, whether we're doing the same thing as others or avoiding something because others are doing it, we're still influenced by those others, even if we may not realize it.
Okay, Jonah, help me understand this. Pretty much the only person that I have, you know, lengthy discussions about money with is my husband, right? I have the influence of my parents and he of his parents. But how does anybody else outside of our marriage have any influence on how we spend money, how much we save for retirement, how we make decisions?
Let me give you a slightly different example, and then we can come back to the money one. So some scientists were interested in how we get people to save energy. Now, obviously, a big, important issue. Energy is getting more expensive. How do we get people to save it? So they went around door-to-door in a community trying out different approaches. So some doors, they knocked on the houses, and they said, hey, saving energy is really important. It'll save you money. Here are some tips. Some other houses, they knocked on the doors. They said, hey, saving energy is really good for the environment. You should do it. They gave them some tips. In the third set of houses, they said, hey, saving energy is really good for the environment. It'll make you a good citizen. And they asked all these people, how much did you like the appeals? How much do you think it'll change their behavior? Everybody said, yeah, I'll definitely change my behavior. Then scientists followed up with them a few months later and actually looked at their energy meters. And what they found was sort of disappointing. They found that though everybody said they'd change their behavior, no one actually did. It was almost like they hadn't even knocked on those doors in the first place. But scientists tried a fourth appeal that actually did work. And that appeal was very simple. All they said was, you know what? Your neighbors are saving energy. The people next door to you, the people in your community, they're turning on their fans. They're turning down their air conditioning. They're turning down their heat in the winter. Your neighbors are doing it. That worked. That got people to save more energy. And there's a great company out there now called O-Power, which uses this exact idea. Rather than just sending you an energy bill every month, they send you a bill with information on it that not only says your energy usage, but also your neighbor's energy usage as well. Someone who has a similar size home to you in the neighborhood. And they found that greatly reduces people's propensity to use energy, greatly decreases their energy use. And the reason very simply is, you know, sometimes we don't know how we're doing unless we look to others. Am I using a lot of energy or a little bit of energy? What is 3,000 kilowatt hours a month anyway? I know it's less than 4,000 and more than 2,000. But is it a lot? Is it a little? I have no idea. Same thing with savings. If you're sitting there going, oh, we're saving some money, well, how do I know if that's a lot or a little? Is $100 a month enough? $1,000, $10,000, $100,000? We really don't have a great sense until we look to others. By comparing ourselves with others, we have a good sense of how we're doing and also how our behavior is going to be affected.
It's so interesting because comparisons can make us feel like we're doing okay. They can also make us feel terrible. You know, there's all that research that says people would rather make less money but make more than their coworkers than, you know, work in the same place but make less than everybody else.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Comparisons can be helpful, but you're very right. The distance of the comparison or the strength of the comparison, how big the gap is quite important. If we're just a little bit behind, we can get a little bit more motivated. You know, if we're not making as much money as our neighbor, but we're pretty close, well, that might motivate us to work a little harder. But if we're really far behind, if we're, you know, making much less money than everyone else around us, well, we're not likely to be motivated. At the office, you know, employers often use employee of the month or sort of who the best person is. They rank people by the number of sales calls they make, for example. But if you're sitting there halfway through the month and, you know, someone else is 50% ahead of you, you're probably going to give up. You feel like that person is so far ahead, there's no way you can collect or you know, shrink the difference. And so proximal peers end up being really important. People that are ahead of us, but just by a little. By comparing ourselves to others that are just a little bit better than us, we won't be demotivated. We'll be more motivated. And as a result, we'll perform better.
And this turns out to be true in sports as well.
Yeah, so you might enjoy this. Your listeners might. We did a big analysis of basketball. I used to be a soccer coach, and I used to find coached U-12 boys out in California, and I used to find that we had a good team, but we never seemed to win at the end of the game, except one time. If we were losing at halftime, sometimes we figured out a way to make it work. And as much as I tried, you know, we couldn't win other times. Why was that? So, with a great collaborator of mine, we ended up looking at tens of thousands of basketball games, both NBA games as well as NCAA games. And we looked at the score at halftime and the score at the end of the game. And we looked to see who was more likely to win, teams that are ahead or behind. Now, not surprisingly, if you were going to bet money on a team at halftime, you should pick the teams that are ahead rather than the teams that are behind. On average, every 2 points a team is ahead at halftime, so 2 points more than an opponent, 4 points, 6 points, and so on. They're about 8% more likely to win the game. Not surprising. But there's one place that you should actually bet on the loser, and that is if a team is losing by just a point. It turns out if teams are losing by just a point, they're more likely to win the game. They're actually more likely to come from behind and win. And the reason is, as we've been talking about, they get more motivated. They're not just behind. They've got a proximal peer right in front of them. They feel like, if I just work a little bit harder, I can close the gap and win the game. And so, sure enough, they come out of halftime fired up. They work a lot harder. They close the gap, and they're more likely to win. And we found the same thing in a bunch of other contexts as well, from simple tasks to other domains. If we feel like we're just a little bit behind, well, that's when our competitive juices get flowing, and that's when we're more likely to perform better.
The thing that's so striking about that is, I'm sure people on both the side that is losing at halftime and the side that is winning would tell you they're always there to win, and they believe sincerely that they're always doing their best.
And that's what I think is so interesting about this research. You know, it's one thing to look at college players. Maybe college players, you know, aren't motivated enough. But NBA players make tens of millions of dollars, and whether they win or lose has a big impact on their income. And so, just as you nicely said, you'd predict they're all pushing as hard as they can, right? They should already be highly motivated. Why should just being a little bit ahead or a little bit behind affect how they do? And yet, even though money should motivate them, even though they're highly skilled, even though they should already be very motivated, that comparison to someone who's doing just a little bit better helps them do better as a result. And so I think that's a really interesting take home for us as individuals, as consumers, as business owners. You know, how can we motivate ourselves by using others? I think about this a lot when I go to the gym. You know, working out, I work out much harder when someone else is there, when I'm working out with a buddy, particularly somebody who's a little bit better than I am. I often try to run with friends that are a little bit faster than I am. Not a lot faster, but just a little bit faster. By comparing myself to a proximal peer, I end up working out harder as a result.
And I should pick that treadmill right in the center of the action next to other people rather than the one I prefer off in the corner. Why?
Yeah, that's also true. You know, it's not just about comparisons. It, literally having other people around can be more motivating. They've done some great studies with this, looking at how fast people complete a task, how fast bikers cycle around, how fast people complete a puzzle. It turns out not just competition, but having other people present, as long as that task is pretty simple, something you've done before, having others around makes us do it faster. So if I ask you to tie your shoes, for example, and someone else is watching you, well, then you'll tie your shoes faster than you would have otherwise. Or, as you nicely pointed out, you know, if I'm exercising, I shouldn't exercise at home by myself. I should make sure to exercise at the gym when other people are around. There's only one caveat to that, and that is for complicated things, or things we're not so good at, well, then having others around can actually hurt. So if we're doing something difficult, like tying a bow tie, for example, or parallel parking, something we're not so good at to begin with, that's a case where others can make it more difficult and we perform worse.
Jonah Berger is my guest. He's professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and author of a new book called Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Wharton School Marketing Professor Jonah Berger, author of Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Jonah, of all decisions that feel very personal to us and like they have very little to do with anybody else, our committed relationships, we don't feel like we choose a partner to please anybody but ourselves.
If you look at how people talk about that relationship in their lives, the person they marry, the person they spend their life with, they often talk about finding the perfect fit, that one person in the world who could ever match with them, the Cinderella in the glass slipper, the other piece to my pod, whatever it may be. If you actually look at the data, though, there's something pretty interesting, which is that most people meet that future person, man or woman, at one of two places, at work or at school. Now, it's possible that one other person in the world, that person who's just right for you, happened to have the cubicle next door your first year of moving into the office, or that they happened to take the same 9 a.m. class that you did in college. But what are the chances that that one person out of the millions in the world that's just right for you was there? Might it actually be more complicated? And so some researchers did a very interesting study to look at this. So imagine you're a student in a class in college. You've been there all semester. And at the end of the semester, the professor asks you to do something very simple. He says, I'm going to show you a few pictures of people, and I'm going to ask you to rate how much you like them and how attractive you find those folks. Easy enough. Sure, why not? So you rate those pictures, and the people look like they could have been in your class, which indeed they had. Unbeknownst to you, these were people that had been in your class over the course of semester, but they actually weren't students. They were actors. The professor had hired three people, I think three or four, to come to class over the course of the semester different numbers of times. Some people came to class every day, some people came to class a couple times, and some people came to class somewhere in between. And what they found, and obviously different people prefer different others, some people like blondes, brunettes, tall, short, we all have different preferences. But what they found is even controlling for all those different preferences that people have, obviously people think they pick someone they like based on their own preferences, how many times those other people came to class mattered. People found the person who came to class the most times more attractive than the person who came to class very few times. And it turns out this has been shown again and again in a variety of domains. It's called mirror exposure, the idea that the more we see something, the more we like it. And so here, even in such an important domain, who we marry, who is our committed relationship partner is for our lives, how many times we've seen that person can play a role. Potentially why we find someone at work or school, not just because they're around, but because we've seen them a number of times and it actually makes us like them more. And it was so interesting. I interviewed the author of this study to talk about his own life and his own spouse. And he actually met his spouse growing up. I think it was in high school. He worked at a grocery store and he was a bagger at the grocery store. And a new woman came in as a checker, and he met her, and he got to know her a little bit, and eventually ended up marrying this woman because they worked at the same grocery store. And it turned out it wasn't just him. The grocery store was a hotbed of romance. It turned out many couples came out of that place. And what's so interesting about that is it's not just us and our preferences. We think we like that one person because they're just funny or they have a personality that exactly fits ours. But part of it is influence that we're unaware of. Part of it is just the number of times we saw them making us like them more and potentially even making us marry them.
All right. So apply this to politics. We have two people running for president of the United States right now, both of whom are very well known to Americans and have been for decades. Are people liking them better for this reason?
What's complicated in these things is we don't have the counterfactual. So we don't know how much people would have liked Trump if we hadn't known about them as much, or Hillary if we hadn't known about her as much. But there is some research that looks at names in elections, and they find that names that are more popular, so names that are more familiar, tend to get a little bit of bump in terms of votes, because people are sitting there going, well, if I'm on the balance, if I'm not sure whether to vote for one person or the other, maybe I'll vote for the person that seems more familiar because I've heard their name wrong. Now, is that going to make a Democrat or Republican or vice versa? Probably not. But on the margin, it matters. We, in some own, of our own research, for example, we even found that where people vote can matter. Voting at a church versus a school, for example, can change what ideas come to mind, and as a result, whether we support a school funding initiative. And so even on something as important, sure it affects our grocery purchases, or sure maybe it affects what chairs we buy in our house, but even important things, even things like who we marry or how we vote on a particular issue, can be subtly shaped by our environment.
Why do so many of the most successful innovations, new products, seem to be the ones that go out of their way to resemble stuff we already had.
There's this notion we have that difference leads to success. And this is true in American culture, you know, the myth of the nonconformist, and also true in business. We think Steve Jobs was so successful because he was different from everybody else. Apple and Google succeed because they've done something no one else has done before. If you actually look at the data, though, that's not exactly right. It's not that Apple or Google was the first company to come in the domain they've been so successful. Google, for example, wasn't the first or the second or even the third to do online search. Some of us might remember Netscape or AltaVista or some of the other ones that have fallen by the wayside. It wasn't actually being different that made Google successful. It was something else. And if you look closer, if you actually look at the data, it turns out that it's not about being different. It's about being what's called optimally distinct. Or similar, but different at the same time. If things are too different, sometimes they're a little bit scary. If something is so different from what people are used to, they're not sure if they need it or how it might fit in their lives. Google Glass, for example, some of your listeners might remember, came out a few years ago. It was a really technology-forward, really amazing product. It allowed you to look at your email and do other things while wearing a pair of glasses. Really neat technology, but was so different from what people were used to that it didn't succeed. Or think about the Segway many years ago now, but a transportation device that wasn't successful. They were so different, people couldn't figure out how to fit it in their own lives. At the same time, too similar can be bad. If something's identical to what's out there already, why do we need to make a switch? You know, Bing came along, Google, everyone was already using it. Bing didn't seem any different than Google was. If anything, it seemed a little bit worse. Why would we switch if it's the same? But in the middle is just right. If we think about Goldilocks of Three Bears fame, you know, on one end was too hot, on the other end was too cold, but in the middle, that porridge was just right. And that's what optimally distinct things are. Just like a Goldilocks effect, they're similar but different at the same time. They're similar enough to feel familiar, so we like them more, just like that idea of mere exposure. But they're different enough, they're unique enough to make us feel like they're worth adopting. There's a great story in the book of how people got cars to be adopted initially. And so today we think about cars. Sure, they're normal. Who would have a trouble adopting a car? But we forget many years ago that cars were actually scary. The first time that an automobile came along, rather than riding a horse or a donkey pulling a carriage, there was this horseless carriage pulling up next to someone at a stoplight or a stop sign or whatever they had at that point in time. People and horses were scared. In rural areas, people called it the devil's work. You know, what is this thing? There's no horse. Where's the hidden horse? And in cities, people were scared of it also. And so one clever inventor said, okay, it's not about being different. It's about being similar and different at the same time. How can I make this thing optimally distinct? So he came out with a new version called a horsey horseless. And essentially what a horsey horseless was is it was what looked like an automobile, no horse, but it had a fake horse head on the front. So literally attaching a fake horse head to the front of a horseless carriage. Now, useless from a functionality standpoint, but it made people more comfortable. They said, oh, it looks a little bit more like something I'm used to. If a horse sees it, it says, oh, this looks a little bit more like something I'm used to. And so it's about making difference feel more familiar. It's about thinking about how we take things distinct and make them optimally so by blending similarity and difference at the same time.
So what does that suggest for people who are looking to market driverless cars in the future?
Yeah, you know, it was very interesting. I was doing some work with Google, and I was out at the Alphabet offsite looking. I sat in a driverless car for the first time. And, you know, one interesting thing to think of is, does it need a steering wheel, for example? Well, on the one hand, eventually it doesn't if it's truly a driverless car. But would that make people feel more comfortable because it resembles an existing car already? Should the shape be something that looks completely different, or should it be something that looks a little bit more familiar? And when I work with companies and organizations, that's exactly what I suggest. You know, when it's a really new innovation, when its technology is discontinuous, very different from what's come before, it's important to cloak it in a feeling of similarity or familiarity. When DVRs first came out, digital video recorders, they actually made them look like VCRs. And this is TiVo and the like. There's no reason it needed to look like a VCR. It didn't have tape inside, so there's no reason it had to have the same shape. But making it look the same made people feel more comfortable and made them more likely to adopt it. And so to the degree that driverless cars feel different, it's a new technology people are a little bit scared of, the more it looks familiar, the more it seems familiar, the more happy they'll be to adopt it.
Okay, so there are situations in which we're influenced by the people around us, and what their influence tells us is that we want to make a different choice. We want to deliberately sort of make ourselves seem distinct from those around us. And one example of this, I guess, is birth order, right? Kids do not want to seem exactly like their siblings when they're growing up in the same house.
Yeah. So what's so interesting to me about social influence is it's not just an attraction. Usually we think about influence, we think about conformity, we think about imitation. Yeah. We think, like in that line study, people going along with the group. But just as often we do the opposite. You know, sometimes we're out to dinner and someone orders the entree we were thinking of getting. Well, we no longer order that entree. We avoid that entree. We pick something else because we want to be different. And so social influence is actually like a magnet. Sometimes it attracts. Sometimes it repels. It causes us to do something different. And there's nothing more powerful than seeing how that works with birth order. So if you talk to most people who have a sibling, an older brother, or younger brother, or sister, you'll notice something peculiar, which is they tend to be a little bit more different than you might expect. After all, they have the same genes. They've grown up in the same household. Shouldn't they have really similar personalities or characteristics? And they do have some, but there's some research that suggests that siblings are just as different personality-wise as two people picked at random in the population. So if they grew up the same way, they have the genetics, wouldn't you expect them to be more the same? And it turns out that it's interestingly more complicated than that. There's some very nice research on birth order and athletes showing that elite athletes tend to be people that have older siblings. So the best soccer players, the best tennis players tend to have older brothers and sisters. And that makes sense. You could say, okay, having an older brother and sister who plays tennis, you tag along to the tennis court, you get a racket when you're young, you try to play with your brother and sister, they're competition, you're playing up, you get better. But it's not that simple. The older brothers and sisters tended to play a sport, but a different sport. Actually, so if they played tennis, well, then you might be successful at baseball. Or if they played golf, you might be successful at football. Why does having someone that played a different sport make you successful? And what's interesting is older brothers and sisters, they provide a path to follow, to imitation, but they also show you that that path is sort of taken already. It's difficult to be better at tennis if your older sibling is already good at tennis. It's difficult to be the smart one, not just in sports, but to be the smart one in the family if your older brother or sister is known as the really smart one. They're older than you. They have a head start. It's difficult to supplant them in that space. And so whether it's about sports or being smart or being artistic, younger siblings learn that that path is a really interesting one, but that path is kind of already taken. And so they tend to differentiate themselves. They tend to diverge. Just like, you know, people that are out to dinner picking a different entree, they tend to pick a different path. If the older one's a smart one, they become the creative one. If the older one's a creative one, they get into sports. And so older brothers and sisters are both a source of imitation, but also one of differentiation.
What makes mimicry such a powerful tool?
Mimicry is one of the most amazing things I learned about while researching the book and was great to write about. It's this idea that we're almost like chameleons. If you think about chameleons, we tend to think about them as blending in with their environment. And it turns out that people do exactly that. So if you and I were talking face-to-face, I can't see you at the moment, but we were face-to-face, and you crossed your legs, I might do the same. If you tilted your head to the side, to the right a little bit, I might do the same. Happens the same thing in language. If you use a certain word, I'm more likely to use that word as well. Even without realizing it, we tend to imitate the mannerisms, the behavior, the language of others that are around us. But it's not just that we do this non-consciously. It actually has some really exciting benefits. So researchers looked at negotiators, what made some negotiators more successful than others. And they looked at hundreds of negotiations, trying to figure out why some people are better and others are worse. Most of us, myself included, hate negotiations. So what makes someone better? They found that a simple trick led negotiators to be five times as successful, five times more likely to reach a deal when all seemed lost. And that trick was simply mimicking or mirroring the behavior of their negotiating partner. Again, if that person crossed their arms, they would do the same. If that person used a certain turn of phrase, they would do the same. Made them five times more likely to succeed. And it's not just negotiators. If a waiter or waitress mimics your order, so if you're out to lunch, for example, and someone says, I'd like a Caesar salad with chicken dressing on the side and a Diet Coke. And the waiter or waitress says, okay, you'd like a salad, Caesar salad with chicken on the side, chicken dressing on the side and a Diet Coke. There, I would be a bad waiter or waitress. It wouldn't happen to me. But if someone did mimic word for word, they would get a 70% higher tip than me, who sort of got the right answer in the end but didn't mimic it word for word. And so the idea very simply is if someone does the same thing as us, it creates a bond. It facilitates that social interaction. If you and I are sitting here and we found out, oh, we have the same birthday in common, or actually went to the same high school many years ago, we'd feel like we have a kinship, like we're part of the same tribe, that we're actually not that different. We have a lot in common. That would make us trust each other more. That would make us like each other more. And that'd make us more likely to become friends. It turns strangers into friends and acquaintances into advocates. Even in a dating context, people whose language tends to match more tend to be more likely to go on a second date. And so it turns out that we not only non-consciously mimic others and they mimic us, but taking advantage of mimicry is a powerful tool to make us more persuasive.
It seems like you would have to do this in a really subtle way, though, or else it just would feel really clunky. Are there ways to use mirroring or mimicry that don't immediately signal the other person that this is what you're trying to do?
You're exactly right. So if you know you were sitting there and you're tapping your feet, you know, arms crossed with your head to the side, and I do exactly that, and then you switch and I do exactly that, that wouldn't be so successful. You know,
right.
Part of the reason this works is that we're not aware that it's happening. And indeed, as with many persuasion attempts, if we feel like someone's trying to change our mind, it's just like kids. You know, if someone tells a kid don't do something, they're more likely to do it. Same thing here. You're more likely to react against it and do the opposite. But doing it subtly, being that chameleon, blending in with your environment, picking some things to imitate and not others, will make it work. An email, for example, a peer of mine was telling a great tip. They said, look, you know, when someone writes to me and they say, dear X, I write back, dear, their name. If they say, hey, my name, I write back, hey, their name. That's a really subtle example. It's not mimicking everything they're doing word for word, just mimicking the introducing word. But it makes you seem like you have more in common and facilitates that interaction.
And I suppose it convinces the other person that you're more likely to understand what it is they have to communicate.
Yeah, I mean, it makes them feel like you're more like them. And actually, interesting you say that. Empathy is a big driver, or at least one of the drivers of mimicry. For people to mimic one another, you have to listen to them in the first place or look at them in the first place. If you're not paying attention to others, it's really hard to imitate or mimic what they're doing. And so empathy plays a big role. When someone sees you mimicking them, at least subtly, as you nicely pointed out, they assume, well, this person must be listening to me, even non-consciously without being aware of it. This person must be like me, non-consciously without being aware of it. And so they say, well, maybe this person's more likely to see things from my perspective, and maybe they're more likely to be along for the ride and go along with me, too.
Jonah Berger is with us. He's professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's just published a new book called Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. We'll take your calls and emails after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. You can also tweet us at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Wharton School marketing professor Jonah Berger. His new book is called Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Logan in Dallas, who writes, Facebook and social media harvest our personal data ravenously. So when we see ads anywhere online, it's extremely likely that they've been tailored to you in a personal way. In 15 years, are we really going to even have a truly organic free will ability to make decisions? Or will our world be so tailored to us that the decisions we make become less truly independent?
Well said. and I think a great, really important question. You see this a lot, you know, not just for products, but in the political domain, where people tend to be friends with other people that have similar political views. And so they get news and information from other people that are on the same side of the aisle, making them think that their views are more and more correct. And the other side is less and less correct, making it less willing to compromise with that other side, because who would in their right mind would think something different when everyone around me seems like they think the same thing as me? So it's certainly a challenge. And people have talked about, you know, filter bubbles or echo chambers, both online and off. I think what's important to realize is this isn't necessarily a new thing. You know, influence or even word of mouth didn't start yesterday or when the internet was invented. If you look at the data, you know, over 85% of word of mouth is still offline. Face-to-face conversations. And the first example of word of mouth wasn't someone tweeting or, you know, liking something on Facebook. It was one caveman kind of nudging another and telling them, you know, don't eat this. It's poisonous. Influence has been around for a long time. How we're influenced and the channels through which influence flows are certainly different than they have been before. But, you know, it's been around forever. It'll be around in another 15 to 20 years. And so the more we're aware of it, the more we can take advantage of its upsides and avoid its downsides. Just like, you know, your great example with the chairs, I think the first place to start is realizing that we're affected. And, you know, this notion of free will is an important one. We all want to think we make our own choices. Many times we don't even today make our own choices. We're subtly influenced by others, and that can be an okay thing. And so I think the more we realize it, that's the first step. And then the second step is saying, great, now that I've realized this influence or identified it, well, how can I take advantage of it to live a happier and healthier life?
How do you think social influence plays into the way we think about differences between people? Does hanging out with people, for instance, who harbor a lot of prejudice, put us in danger of thinking less fairly about individuals?
Yeah, I mean, the one big takeaway from the book in general is be careful of your peers. You know, pick your peers very, very carefully. And, you know, we do have some choice of that about our friends or our children's friends, because this influence is going to spread among the people that we spend our time with. The more we spend time with someone, the more we interact with them, the more likely we'll start to adopt their views. And so, you know, you may have a friend at the beginning that seems like, oh, you know, they're a little bit far out there on some of their views, but after a while, you'll start to think that's more correct. Because you're sitting there going, well, I like this person, they're my friend, and they have this particular view, and I want to keep liking them, and so I can't keep liking them if I think their view is wrong. And so we start to see their side of the table. Now, that's great in some ways, right? That allows us to take different perspectives when we might be wrong. You know, we're not always right. And so recognizing that other people have different views, seeing it from their perspective, understanding where they're coming from is really powerful. But it can also lead us astray. And I think particularly in today's, you know, very charged racial climate, for example, in the United States, it's really important not just to say that we understand, but really try to see things from someone else's eyes, really try to go through the life of whether it's someone who's a minority in the U.S. and see what it's like to be treated like a minority, or from, you know, a police officer side and see what it's like to be a police officer for a day. I think one of the challenges is each side in any debate underestimates what it's like to be the other side. And each side has some really important points of view. And so if the other side can see those perspectives, it's much more likely they'll reach an agreement in the middle.
Okay, let's talk about baby names for a minute. Very few people want their kid to show up on the first day of kindergarten with five other kids who have the same first name. And yet we know that popular names come and go. People are trying to give their children names that feel fresh to them. Are they also, without realizing it, trying to fit in with the crowd?
I don't have kids, but without fail, I've heard this true of anyone I know who has school-age kids, where they spend forever picking a name that's perfect for just them. You know, it's some great uncle's name that no one would have ever heard of, and they like it, and it's just theirs, and they get to kindergarten, and there's another two of them. And they're sitting there going, how is this possible? I spent all this time and effort picking something I liked that no one else liked. How did we end up in the same place? And it turns out, just like your stools and just like many of the things we've been talking about, even something like the name we give our children is shaped by our environment. We looked, analyzed over 100 years of baby names, over 240 million births in the United States, to look at what led certain names to be popular and unpopular. And we found that it wasn't random or luck. You know, could we predict the popularity of what's going to be liked next? Indeed, we were. We found some traction on it. It was quite interesting. We found, for example, that hurricanes had an effect on baby names. Now, you might say hurricanes, of course. I know Hurricane Katrina happens. No one would name their child Katrina, right? Well, it turns out that's not the only effect that Katrina has. Baby names that start with K are actually 10% more likely, so 10% more popular after Hurricane Katrina happens. So why would Katrina increase the number of children born with a K name? And it wasn't just hurricanes, by the way. We found the same thing in names more generally. So if a name is popular, let's say Katie is popular, popular this year. Well, other names like Catherine and Katrina or Kate or Carl, other names that have that same sound at the beginning, are more likely to be popular next. And it turns out it's this exact idea of being similar and different. You hear a name more often, you like that name more. So let's take the name Katrina. Even if there's a hurricane, hearing it more will make that name sound more familiar, just like that other person in your class, seeing them more times, sound more familiar and make you like it more. But you're not going to give your child that exact name, right? I mean, after all, it's been so popular, you might recognize it's popular. But without you being aware of it, other names that sound the same are also more likely to be popular. If Jane is popular this year, then Jack and Jody are more likely to be popular next year because they start with the same sound. And so it's not just the whole name, but hearing that sound more often makes us like it more. But again, we're picking something similar and different. We're picking the same sound, but a different rest of the name. And so it allows us to feel unique, even though we're being shaped subtly by our environment.
We have an email here from Jay who wants to know how we learn to be influenced. Is it evolutionary and inherent, or is it something that we learn by observing others being influenced when we're kids?
Imagine you're a child, you're a baby, and a couple friends of mine, it's been amazing to watch their baby develop. And the world is completely new, right? I mean, everything you see, everything you're trying to do is completely new to you. It's not just like going to a different country where they don't speak your language, which is true also, but nothing makes sense. You can't move any of your limbs the way you want, and you're supposed to basically figure it out. You know, how would you do that? It would be amazingly difficult. And so there's been some mechanism through evolution to help us with this. So one of them, science suggests, is called mirror neurons. And basically what that is when you reach for something, for example, some neurons go off in your mind. So you reach for a cup, a certain area of your brain lights up. But it turns out that same brain region also lights up if you see other people doing that thing. So if you see someone else pick up a cup, for example, that same region might light up as well. And so what that does is it facilitates learning. But if you're a baby, you watch someone else pick up a cup, it activates the same region for you for picking up that cup. In a sense, it potentiates or making it easier for you to pick up the cup or engage in the same action. You see someone smiling, it activates the region that will help you learn how to smile. And so imitation is definitely biologically bound. There's some even evidence that differentiation is rewarding. And so we learn that in a similar way, and it has some biological basis as well.
One of the things you write about toward the end of the book is the influence of poverty on long-term outcomes and what can happen if you move children out of poverty before they hit their teens. You don't necessarily move them, they don't necessarily gain a great deal of income within their own families, but they stop living in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty. What happens?
So imagine you've grown up in poverty. You're in a neighborhood that's quite impoverished. Not surprisingly, you don't have as good life outcomes as you might if you were raised in a more affluent situation. There are not as many resources. There are not as many after-school training programs. There are not as many opportunities. And so life is, not surprisingly, a bit harder. But it's hard to know how much of that is nature, how much of it is nurture. Can we tease these things apart? And there was recently policy work done on this that allowed for a nice natural experiment. So some people were given the opportunity to move to a new community. Some folks that might have lived in a lower income neighborhood surrounded by poverty were given the opportunity to move to a new neighborhood. How might that affect their life and well-being? And the program is called Moving to Opportunity. And it's a little bit interesting because it's like, imagine you could take your child and move them to a completely different situation. Imagine you could pick a peer group for your child. Would they be better off? And so what they found here is that moving to new environment, changing the influences around you, had a huge impact on life outcomes. People made more money, they were healthier, they were happier. Across a host of different domains, their life outcomes were better simply by changing the neighborhood they were in. Now, it's difficult to know exactly why this happened, right? I mean, there are many reasons. Some of it might be more opportunities, some of it might be better schools, but some of it is certainly the peers that people were surrounded by. If you live in a neighborhood of poverty, not only don't you have a lot of opportunities or as many opportunities, but you're surrounded by people that also don't have opportunities and may have taken up some bad habits. There may be people committing crimes, for example, and rather than studying hard in school, they're hanging out. There are not a lot of places to get great fruits and vegetables, so you end up eating fast food. You see other people doing the same. So it's hard to tease out whether it's the environment or the peers, but what this work definitely shows is that the environment and the peers are really important. If we can shift who we surround ourselves with, we can have much better life outcomes.
Can you explain to our listeners why there is a photograph in the book of a Louis Vuitton branded garbage bag?
So one thing we haven't talked about very much is the meaning of our choices, what it signals about us to choose something in particular. And we went out and looked at a bunch of different counterfeits, and there was a great example where Louis Vuitton actually does not make counterfeit trash bags, but there are Louis Vuitton trash bags out there. Why would someone buy a Louis Vuitton trash bag? Well, part of it is what we want to signal about us, right? We don't just buy things for what they do. We also buy them for what they mean. We buy certain cars, for example, for what it communicates about who we are. We engage in certain behaviors. But even important things like politics are shaped by what they mean. I did a project recently with a group that wanted to get people to adopt clean energy. They wanted conservatives to support wind power and solar power. And these should be issues that conservatives like. They help national security. That's a good thing. Conservatives should like it. Yet conservatives don't. And so when they ask conservatives, well, why don't you support clean energy? Many conservatives ended up saying, you know, Al Gore supports clean energy. And if it's something that Al Gore likes, it's probably not for me. And what's so interesting there is the issue is the same. Clean energy is the same. It is what it is. But who else is doing it has a big impact on whether we're going to do it or not. And it's not just an attraction. We don't just do things that other people we like are doing or other people we want to look like. Brands obviously try to use this a lot. They think, okay, if we associate a celebrity with a product, people will be more likely to do it. But we also avoid things that people we want to avoid being associated with are doing. There's a fun example of a handbag company. I believe it was Gucci. And Snooki, a character from the Jersey Shore. Your listeners may remember that old television show from a few years ago. She was the one with the terrible mouth. She had so much fake tanner that she looked like a parking cone. She actually got a free handbag in the mail from Gucci. That makes sense. Product placement. Maybe Gucci wanted her to wear it. They thought if she's using it, she'll get photographed. More people buy the bag. But it wasn't that Gucci sent her the handbag. It was actually one of their competitors that sent her the handbag. Why would their competitor send her a handbag? Why would they help out Gucci? Interestingly, something similar happened to one of her cast members, Mike the Situation Sorrentino. He's the guy with the abs. He got a letter from Abercrombie & Fitch offering to pay him money. But it wasn't paying him money to wear their clothes. It was actually paying him money not to wear their clothes. Why would they do that? And so what's interesting in both these examples, it's a case where Abercrombie was saying, look, if he's wearing these clothes, maybe other people won't want to do it. Because if someone like him is doing it, maybe people won't want to do it. Same with Gucci. One of their competitors thought if she's wearing a Gucci bag, maybe many people will avoid that bag because they don't want to look like her. And so as we've been talking about, you know, influence works both ways. Sometimes it attracts us. We want to be the same as others. But there are multiple flavors of influence. Just as often we avoid something or move away from something, abandon something because we don't want to look like the person that's doing it.
I know that you're a professor of marketing, but what advice would you give to people who are trying to resist the sales pitch?
You know, the first way to resist that pitch is being aware that it's occurring. If we don't realize that it's happening, if we don't realize that we've bought the same thing as our neighbors, or we don't realize that we're buying something because we saw an ad, there's no way we can be aware it's happening. And so the first thing is to just tune our radar a little bit. The more we understand about it, the more we can, you know, make better decisions and avoid being influenced. But I wrote this book really not necessarily to help people avoid influence, but to help people choose their influence. You know, we're not total robots. We're not totally affected by everything that goes around us. The more we understand influence, the more we can pick when we want to be influenced and when we don't. And if we understand that, well, we'll be more successful overall.
Jonah Berger is professor of marketing at the Wharton School and author of the new book, Invisible Influence, The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. Jonah, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Frankie Paris, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. And you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.